I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole. For over 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store in Charlotte, North Carolina. On this podcast, we unlock the stories of people's lives through the stories of what they wore. These aren't conversations about fashion. These are conversations about people. I'm incredibly inspired by the designers and friends I meet on the road, but I'm most inspired by my talented colleagues at home in our Charlotte office, like our very own Scott Newkirk. Scott generously shares his journey of leaving Mississippi for New York City, his work as a highly regarded fashion stylist for Calvin Klein and Coach, and the personal difficulties he faced, finding himself along the way. We work together in many capacities, but I want you to know that I have known about you for a really long time, way before I met you.
You're kidding me.
I've known about you for 25 years. Perry, my husband, always said you were the most talented person he ever met in his entire life.
Wow.
So we've worked together now, not long.
4 years.
4 years. Or so. Where are you from?
I'm from Mississippi. I was born in Jackson, and then we moved out to a suburb of Jackson, Madison, when I was probably in the third grade, and kind of lived there until I ran off to New York.
And what was it like growing up in Mississippi in the 60s?
I always talk about really loving the time that I grew up, because there was this shift from the 20s and 30s. We lived out in this little town that was like stepping back in time. I mean, yeah. It still had the old general store with the Coke machine on the front porch and the screen door. I mean, nothing had changed. And then like 1970 hit, and there was a Junior Food Mart, and everything started changing. But before that, it was really like being, it could have been 1940.
Yeah.
Music was amazing. I mean, just the whole time was great. It was
food
quiet
was
out there. Food was amazing. We went to public school for the first couple of years, and then we went like half an hour away to a private school for couple of years, and then back in Madison. So this was all during, you know, integration and all that stuff. So that was kind of crazy. My mom was a teacher.
Yeah.
So
a Spanish teacher.
A Spanish teacher and English and kind of whatever else she did. You know, she
at the private school?
At every school that I went to.
Oh really?
Which was from third grade on, yeah. So that was kind of interesting.
And you're one of three.
Yeah. I've got an older brother.
And where are you? You're the baby?
I'm in the middle.
Oh, you're in the middle.
It was interesting, more really looking back. I think really when I was there, I mean, most of my thoughts about growing up there are in retrospect, because living there was kind of not very interesting. And I was kind of not really that happy with what was happening. And I just kind of wanted to get out of there. I think I always just felt like, you know, I need to go.
What part of that? Just because there weren't opportunities to be who you were or work how you wanted to work, or did you even know?
I don't know. I never really felt connected to where I lived in a lot of ways. And, you know, my folks were really interesting, pretty straightforward people. But
were they both from Mississippi?
They are.
Yeah.
My dad grew up in Maryland, went to a boarding school there. His parents divorced, you know, so he grew up kind of in the north and then came back for college. And my mom grew up there. And they always really encouraged us to get out of Mississippi and explore the world, you know? So I don't think that was always in the back of my mind, but I didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do, how I wanted to approach my life at all until, I don't know, really until I dropped out of college.
May I ask what it was like being gay in the South and being in Mississippi? And did you know your whole life? And was that part of wanting to leave and be in New York and have that freedom, or was it more career driven?
It was totally career driven. And in fact, it was such a deep, deep suppressed thing for me. I was so afraid of what that meant. There was no one, there was no lifestyle to sort of parallel with, to ever be like, okay, that's cool.
I could do this. Or this is how
I just basically buried that.
Yeah.
And I was even, you know, Norman, my first roommate, was gay, and obviously he it was like the first day I walked in, he was like, "So you're gay?" I'm like, "No, I swear."
Really?
No, I mean, I was completely in denial. You know, it was 6 months until I was there. And basically, I feel like I started to realize I was finally living in a place where it wasn't an issue. And I think that was the biggest thing for me, is it freed me in a way that I never had been able to live and think and express myself and not be afraid of that. And I remember that when I basically waited until I found somebody who I had a crush on before I was able to say, like, you know, without that, there was no reason to come out.
Right,
you know,
right.
I needed someone there to give it an excuse. And and when I did, it was, I'm telling you, for 2 days, I felt like I was floating. There was so much that felt like had been pushed on me for so long.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Living there, I mean, I just always felt uncomfortable. Just this need to leave and figure out, like, you know, there's something else. There's something else out there. There's a person inside of me that I haven't even seen yet or haven't even discovered yet. Leaving school was the first step of starting to sort of make decisions for myself and then immediately sort of finding positive results from everything I was doing and just getting that constant feedback every step I took, and then moving to New York and having a job immediately and, you know, just falling, things just like fell into place in such a magical way. And not only professionally, but also just, you know, starting to be able to live and to even be able to talk about this freely, you know, I would have never imagined it at one point in my life. And it's pretty liberating and joyous to be able to.
Yeah. What was it like your first time back to Mississippi when you were that person? You were your fully realized person.
I felt fabulous. Not even because of that, but I was also, it was just the first time I came home. And it was a long time before I did.
Yeah.
Because my sister was living in Cambridge. Uh-huh. She didn't always go home for Christmas, so I would stay up there with her. So it was several years of living in New York before I came home. And so by that time, I was, you know, working in these places, and I had already started to see so much and going out to clubs and just the richness of my life that I had always maybe dreamed of was starting to sort of happen, and I was feeling it. And to come back with all of that kind of armor, almost, like, you know, of confidence and experience of having seen things and done things that I would have never been able to do. I mean, it was wonderful, actually, and to, you know, tell stories and see old friends, and it was great, but I felt really disconnected to it all.
Yeah.
And like, I can't wait to get back to New York and, you know,
and
continue my life.
Again.
Yeah. I didn't come out to my family officially, really. My mom came back up there. She started teaching again and spent, I think, 6 weeks with me while she went to the new school to kind of brush up on teaching again. And it was only in that time that she was there that I was like, okay, guess what, Mom?
In New York.
In New York.
So
I didn't want to come home for a weekend and make this whole weekend about my being gay. It just seemed like a real bore. And I didn't want, it didn't seem like that big of a deal.
Yeah.
So it really was really finding out that moment that I could actually have a conversation with my mom.
And what did your mom say?
She was like,
duh.
Ever since you said you want to be an angel when you were in first grade, I knew that, you know, she was no surprise.
Yeah.
All of my family's been amazing, and most people are.
Yeah.
To a certain degree. Thank goodness I'm gay. I'm serious. I mean, the things that I had
would have been a nightmare.
The things that I had to learn and face and struggle with and overcome in a time when, and most people just really never have to think about that. And the way that matured you, I'm really grateful for it.
I am too.
Yeah, it's cool.
I'm glad you are. You.
Thank you. You know,
were you always interested in fashion or design?
You know, I think it was something that was around in my head. I didn't ever think about it as a profession at all. I was just,
well, probably because
I liked
you didn't
clothes.
See that opportunity. You know,
I,
like,
no,
how
not
could
at all.
You see?
There was
what?
No way. There was no way at all. It didn't even dawn on me until I got my first job after I left school. So before that, it was just like, I like fashion and I like clothes, and, you know, I would embarrassingly help my mother out, pick out clothes when I was in like fifth grade, and, you know, secretly loved it. But
where would you shop? Where was
McRae's?
There? McRae's. Well, obviously McRae's.
You know, I mean, you know, she was a teacher, and, you know, it's not like she was ever going to wear anything fabulous, but it was still, she kind of depended on me for it.
Yeah.
There was this little phase I remember like that, but all the money I made at any job I had went to go shopping at the mall and buy, like, you know, disco jeans.
I was going to say, what was the thing to buy then in
the
70s?
No, seriously, I was a victim of Saturday Night Fever and Fleetwood Mac and that whole
that's
thing.
That's not a victim. That's
I mean, no,
that's
I mean, a, that was, it was amazing. It was great. It was really great. But I was all into those embellished jeans and all that stuff. And
they made their way to Mississippi? Like, did you?
They did. I can't, merry-go-round, baby. That was,
okay.
That was where I shopped.
Right.
One of the places. I mean, I've got nothing left from that time that is even worth talking about, but I was not exactly a traditional spirit. In fact, I guess I kind of was trying to buck all of that. I didn't know what I wanted. I just knew that everything around me was not
what you
at
wanted.
All.
Yeah. And so, had you been to New York as a young person?
Never.
How did you?
No, honestly, it did not even cross my mind until about a year before I left.
So you went to college for art?
A year and a half. No, I just went to college.
for just college.
And I didn't do anything when I was there. I mean, I did decent my first year, and then my sophomore year, I think 6 weeks, not even in, I was just like, I'm out of here.
Did your mother freak out?
Not at all. No. So first, I don't know why they were encouraging and that they had any reason to believe I was going to be able to make anything of myself, because I'd never proven anything like that before. I had no direction at all in what I was going to do. And I just walked into this little store that had just opened called Clothiers and Company. It'd been open for about a year, I think. It was a really cool small men's and women's traditional clothing store. And this was 1980, and I did sales. And the moment that job started, and I sort of started creating my own world, seeing myself in a professional way. It was the first time I really felt like there was something I was able to do really well. And I kind of started really getting involved in the doing their windows and the visual merchandising, stuff like that, because nobody really was taking that on and it needed to be done. And it was just like...
natural.
It was just, yeah, it was really just instinct.
How did you know how windows should look, or how dress forms should be? I mean,
no,
it's totally self-taught and just innate.
Completely. I know I remember looking at Jean Meyer's windows at Tiffany's, you know, in books, and that was sort of an inspiration. And also Rubenstein's in New Orleans. I would drive down there and steal ideas and come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it really, I
how
mean.
How far was it?
3 hours.
Okay.
It was, the way I always looked at it was just a little bit of whimsical humor, a little bit of fantasy, you know, there was always a little, some kind of little story going on that I was trying to do, or just some kind of. It's really simple ideas, but it was a blast.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd never been more creative in my life. I think even then, because I was so naive and didn't know what I was doing, I could take all kinds of risks and everything kind of worked.
Did you ever take art in school or no? Not really.
Yeah. I mean, I had an art class, but.
Interesting. And then how long were you there, and how did you
get
from there to
New York? I guess I moved to New York in January of 85. So I was probably 4 solid years of that work. I sort of left the store and just continue their freelance, and was doing windows for a few different stores and working as a waiter and just kind of having a great time. And then my friend Anne,
yeah,
moved to New York maybe a year before I did. So that sort of got that into my head, and I thought, maybe I should try that.
And she was married to our 6 degrees of separation.
Exactly.
Mark McNary, who's my husband's college roommate.
Exactly.
And then, so you got to New York, and how much money did you bring? Like, did you bring furniture?
Gosh. No, you know, I remember I got in the cab, and I had a $100 money order, or what do you, traveler's
oh
check.
Oh my God, yes, traveler's check. Oh my God, I love that.
And, you know, I don't really have any cash. I was in a taxi from the airport with my dad's old Air Force duffel bag, which for some reason have lost, which killed me. But I mean, I probably had $300.
And you went to stay with Anne?
No, I actually, when I first went to New York in November of 84, there was a guy that I knew who worked in a restaurant mm-hmm. in Jackson and had left and gone there. And he was working for Armani. And so I kind of knew him and I stayed with him. He introduced me to his boss. Norman was his boss. He was the director of the Armani boutique, which had been only open for a couple of years. The man at the time. Norman needed a roommate. I needed an apartment. Also, Norman introduced me to the folks at Barney's. I interviewed while I was there in November. They hired me when I came back in January, so I had a job. And
did you about die when you saw the windows at Barney's after doing those windows in Jackson? And you were like,
I mean,
how is this really happening?
I never really thought about it. I just kind of just did it, you know.
But just that somebody was doing the windows the way you were thinking about them.
Yeah, it was on such a different scale. I mean, it was kind of a fantasy come to life, and you know, and Barney's was.
And you worked in the visual merchandising in the windows with Simon Doonan.
Eventually, there was someone before that who had been there for years, Guy Scarangello, and he was the one that hired me originally. Simon came along later, but I only was there for about a year and a half, and then I started doing freelance work.
I did windows
for Bendel's, and I did a little bit more freelance there. And then I was also just, you know, Armani. I was working at. I would go in there pretty much every day, kind of take care of the store at the end of the day. And so I was
visual merchandising, mm-hmm. like redoing the
mannequins.
So I would
do the windows. Yeah, so 6 months after I moved in with Norman, they eventually hired me to work there as well. So I was, at the end of the day at Barney's, I would take the subway uptown and spend a couple hours at Armani and kind of do all that. So it was pretty amazing. I mean, you know, the thing that was so crazy about Barney's, it was just the first time I'd ever seen these clothes that I had seen in Interview Magazine. And,
right.
You know, it was like, you know, Gautier and Alaya and you know, these things that I didn't even know how to pronounce. And,
yeah.
you know, you could actually, I mean, the thing that was so amazing about the work that we did, we were really kind of behind the scenes all the time. So, and we were the ones, I mean, I really focused less on windows. I was more into putting clothes on the mannequins and really basically the beginning of being a stylist and without even knowing it.
And that didn't really exist then. I mean, you probably were the, you probably created the whole idea.
I mean, I didn't, but there weren't very many of them. I mean, it seems like, I mean, they were magazine editors, but the term stylist just wasn't something you heard about that much.
And explain what that is and what
for me in the time that I was doing it. And I'll remember for so many years, I had to correct everyone. No, I'm not a hairstylist.
You have good hair, though. I can see why they would think that.
When you think about an advertising image, there are five characters involved. You've got an art director, a hair person, a makeup person, a model, a photographer, and a stylist. So that's actually six. Whatever is in the world of the clothes, I'm responsible for. So it's
an making it look. An art director is the scene, the actual place, and stylist is the actual clothes?
Exactly. So it's you know, if you're shooting for a company that has their own clothes, then you're just making those clothes look great. If you're shooting for a company that doesn't make clothes, then you're pulling clothes together to enhance whatever the product is that you're shooting. So trying to make it look as messy or neat or whatever as it might need to be. It's a lot of tugging and pulling. And
you amazing. Also, it was a beginning, you worked with brands like Calvin Klein and J. Crew and Coach and in the 80s, that the beginning of...
In the really... So I started doing that in probably 87. I was working for Robert Ruffino, who was had just started working as a stylist, and I met him at Bendel's. We became friends. I became his assistant, and we worked together for 3 years. And we were doing editorial for mostly New York Times Magazine, home design, men's and women's fashion. So I mean, I didn't even realize how much prestige that had, and you know, everybody opened the door to us. I mean, I was 26 years old or something, you know, and. Which sounds old to some degree, but I felt like really a kid, you know. Yeah.
What's your favorite project you remember working on at that time?
I loved doing shows. Calvin Klein, I mean, that was pretty incredible.
And that's you, like, actually putting, like, tying a sweater around the waist?
So, I started doing...
What goes with what?
The first job I did with them was their first men's collection that they were reintroducing. John Varvatos was the designer. Uh-huh. I walked into this gigantic room with... seemed like thousands of pieces of clothing in them. And I was
and
not
John
the,
there?
John was there. Uh-huh. Tani was there. Yeah. She was the fashion director at the time. I was just a freelance person that they brought in because they had a woman that had worked at Armani had moved over there and to head up PR and called me in. She said, Calvin doesn't like the mannequins. Can you come in and change them? So I was like, sure. So I went up there, spent a couple hours one afternoon. And
they
called
look
me the next day. I don't know. They just were like, what they were. And they're like, he wants you to work on the show. I was like, okay, sure. You know, whatever that means. I mean, it was.
Like, are you nervous when you went to sleep that night? Or are you like.
I don't remember being nervous. I mean, I really feel like I just walked blindly through this whole thing. And just, you know, but it was pretty impressive to when he walked into the room the very first time. I mean.
And he walked in and saw what you had styled?
Eventually. I mean, basically, so the whole process is you've got all these clothes and you've got to create a point of view.
Yeah.
And really there wasn't anybody telling me what to do and what not to do and or how to do it. Uh-huh. And I had done things before, but that was on such a different level. So it's because there was so much to sort of consider. So you really just start by pulling out the things that you like and putting them on a rack and, you know, putting clothes together. And so you're basically putting all the looks together. You're putting them
on
a model, photographing it, documenting it, editing it, looking at models for the show, then selecting models, doing fittings. I mean, it's that whole process.
And is there input from John, like John saying, like,
sure,
I don't like that.
Yeah, but he wasn't really like that. I mean,
really?
You know.
I mean, I think it's so interesting that the artist essentially would be able to give up their art for you to mess with.
I don't know if I could do it.
I don't think I could do it.
But, you know, they did. And I don't know. Somehow,
and then Calvin comes in and says, yes, no.
This looks great. I don't like it. I mean, yeah, I mean, he was pretty much yes to it. It was pretty cool.
It was pretty successful.
It was pretty cool. I mean, and, you know, there was a time at a point during that whole thing, it was as if he wouldn't make any decision unless I'd looked at it. And it was like, okay, great. This is pretty crazy. He would drive me home. We both lived on the Upper West Side. I'd go home. His driver would take us both back to each house in the back of his Mercedes. It was like, what is going on?
You're 26 years old.
Like, you know, I was a little bit older at that point, but it was crazy. I mean, this was 1993. Grunge had just happened. the birth of the waves. I mean, Kate's first few days, you know, to be involved with that was magical. That yeah. place, but shows in general are a lot of fun because you're in and out of it within 10 days,
right?
And
there's a result.
The excitement is incredible.
Who was your favorite person to style?
I saw David Bowie for details. Almost forgot about that.
Oh my god!
Can you believe it? No, seriously, it's so many years of it, really.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can tell you a favorite. I mean, what I really enjoyed was I loved the work that I did with Coach, which was for like 14 years. And even though it was sort of a middle of the road brand, I had so much freedom to do whatever I wanted there. And yeah. so there was a lot of pleasure in the work there because unlimited budget. I basically had to create a miniature clothing collection for every photo shoot.
Wow.
I would basically shop at you know, Barney's and Bergdorf's and pull shapes uh-huh. of pieces because you're always working off season. So there's never exactly what you want. It's all about color and all that stuff. And so I would pull a couple of rolling racks full of shapes, kind of go through there and kind of in my mind imagine outfits. But then I'd spend 2 days in fabric stores. And all that had to be done. Within 3 days, I had to basically figure out, you know, what would be, you know, 30 shots. Hmm. And get them to tailors to get them everything made within wow. a week. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Plus renting, you know, lots of great vintage stuff. I mean,
it was
really fun because I started to kind of really create a point of view for how that looked. And that was really fun to sort of see that reveal itself over those years of working there. And working with Reed was incredible because he was really generous with me and
so talented.
Let me do just kind of whatever I wanted to, which is great.
Wow. One of my favorite things that you did at that time, too, was build a house with your own hands.
I built it with my own hands in my mind. you know, I couldn't build a house. I could build
you did a lot of it yourself. Your house is on the cover of a book called Cabin Porn.
Exactly.
Right. But it's a really famous house.
It is actually more famous than I'll ever be. And it's actually, it's pretty incredible. You know, I bought this property upstate in like 2000. It was like 50 acres on this brook. And I put up this little sort of tent cabin thing on a deck. It ended up burning after the first couple of years or something. Left a candle burning, you know me. But it really, you know, 2 weeks later, I had sort of sketched out this other house that had been inspired by this old book called Handmade Houses. It took 3 years to get that thing built. I mean, it was ridiculous because there's no power, there's no water. It was not a job anybody wanted to do, but I mean, it was pretty, it's pretty magical.
Very,
pretty magical.
Very magical.
I just got in touch with the guy that bought it from me and yesterday saying I was going up there because I'm going up there for the first time in like 7 years.
Week and you're after gonna go next. See it?
And I'm going to check it out. I haven't even read his message, but.
What's that going to be like?
Probably bittersweet and lovely. He's done everything that I would have done had I kept it. I mean, he's built his own place. Other people have built houses on the property. I mean, it's pretty cool what he's done. I'm kind of interested to see it, but he's kept that place fairly intact, still refers to it as Scott's cabin.
Yeah.
Pretty generous of him.
Yeah. And you move, and I think it does work in tandem, but you sort of moved into interiors more or?
It's always sort of been in my personal life. And, you know, it's always been something that is extremely important to me is really living in an environment that I can create that just has, that reflects just my past, everything that I want to know about, everything that I'm afraid of, everything that I've fallen in love with.
Which are sometimes the same things.
So. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've always just needed to kind of come home to a place that I could sort of reflect on and feel like, wow, this is mine. This is my place. This is my home. So that's always been important. So, you know, there's always been an interest there. I mean, I don't know how to do anything else except for sort of create a beautiful space and, you know, put some clothes on. And really that's it. So and that's not to talk it down, but that's what I do, you know?
But, I think you're also like a fixer. Like I think just.
I mean, I think we're all troubleshooters and problem solvers. And when I moved to Brooklyn, which was the last 4 years,
and that was a firehouse.
It was an old firehouse built in the 1800s, and it was massive, and it was incredible. I mean, it was really a great way to sort of sign off to New York to spend some time in that place and create a space that really was everything I'd kind of wanted to live around and be around. It was fun. It was just a way to really, I always treated it like a little bit of a laboratory for me to sort of play around with ideas. And I didn't care if they were good or bad. None of it mattered because it was just, you know, sort of a place to experiment with things that I'm thinking about.
And tell me about leaving New York.
You know, I think I still haven't even mourned it at this point. I think I do just in little bits and pieces. You know,
you were there 30 years?
I was there almost 30 years. So I guess in March of 2013, my work changed. I was really kind of, I've been tired of being a stylist for many years. And I would say every 5 years, it's the last year I'm going to do this. And at this point, I was...
But you just make too much money doing it.
You know, and it was, you know, of course, you look back and you think, God, I had it so good. And I didn't have to work every day. And, you know, all this stuff that you take for granted. And I really lived in this, you know, as many of us did, this sort of privileged bubble that doesn't even really exist anymore.
It doesn't exist anymore, yeah.
At all. I just have been a bit of an adventure seeker in my life. And I think I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't know what I want to do, but I know just like when I was quit college, I didn't want to be there. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I knew that if I left, I could figure it out.
You'd find it.
So I just needed to get out of there. And so I went home. My dad has been not doing well for many years, for 5-6 years. And at the time I left, I thought he was going to pass away in the next month or two or three or whatever. So I was like, let me go home. Let me reconnect with my family. Let me clear my head. Let me just sort of see what kind of comes to the surface and something's going to present itself to me and I will move on to the next place in my life. And Perry called after 25 years. And it's like, what are you doing? I was like, nothing. And I started kind of coming back and forth here, which was, you know, just who would have thought?
Who would have thought? And you've described New York as sort of an addiction. Like,
oh my God, completely. You know, it's everything about it I love, you know, and I think because I grew up in, I really did grow up there in a way. And in such an incredible time for New York
that's not there now.
No. And so much of my loss for what's there is just, you know, it's all sentimental. And, you know, I think if I ever were to go back, it wouldn't be what it was. Mm-hmm. And even when I do go back, I'm sort of almost feel like a stranger, which is really weird. It was like the first time that really happened. I think last trip we were in New York, I was just like, I feel like I don't know anybody anymore, which is weird. Cause I knew everybody. I knew, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
It felt like, you know, I knew every parking lot attendant because I drove. I mean, it was funny, the connection that you have with it. And it's such a place that because you walk everywhere, it really is a small place. And my work required me to be everywhere all the time. So I felt really, really connected to so many parts of it. And it just the culture that you're just living among all the time. I don't know, the people you talk to every day. And it was just this vital, creative existence that I don't think I'll ever find anywhere else. It's just, you know. So I miss that. I miss that very much. And it's hard to replace it. I mean, I didn't have to work to learn anything.
Yeah.
I was just being informed all the time.
Right.
And there's something so addictive about that, just to be sort of always consciously aware of things that are happening all around the world and they're happening, you know, a block away from you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty cool. Mm.
So you are now developing private label suiting for the men's store. And so, and what's that like too, to move away from interiors and back into fashion? And you know, you can never get too far away from fashion.
It's the longest relationship I've had with anything. And it's been really good to me. And it's just what I know.
What sparked the idea? Why?
If we can't find it, let's make it.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. I feel like there was a lack of real tailored clothing at the store from all the vendors that we worked with. There was just nothing, even for myself. I mean, I really sort of look at myself as a kind of possible typical customer to some degree. And I think I just want a beautiful jacket. I just want to feel like a gentleman today. And we don't really have that.
It's funny, that's hard to find.
And so that was one of the things. And just to feel like we had something that was ours and that we were seeing through our eyes and interpreting. So it's been fun developing that. I mean, it's...
And how'd you find the manufacturer?
Mark, I think, mentioned that to us, McNary.
Yeah.
He suggested them. I think we have known about them. I think, you know, Perry was aware of them. Southwick.
Southwick. And they're based?
In right outside of Boston.
Okay. Yep. And how long have they been?
Oh gosh, since like the 40s.
Wow.
Long time.
And when you got there, you could just tell, like you connected to it immediately?
Yeah. The attention to the detail and the number of times that things get inspected and for fit and construction and all that. It was really impressive. And they had a pretty great selection of fabrics that we could work from. I'd like to expand on that. You know, we sort of.
So what did you produce? What are the first?
We have got two suits and four jackets, a gray flannel suit, a navy sort of tropical wool suit that's great, and then four different tweeds with two different models. So there's a sack jacket, and then there's something that's a little bit more tailored. And, you know, I think it looks beautiful together. It's a lot of variety, and it's a lot of fun.
You're excited about
I'm very excited about it. I've kind of been spending the last week sort of thinking about, you know, how we're going to approach promoting it and, you know, giving a stab at naming the models and things like that, which is a lot of fun. So, yeah.
And you're also the buyer.
Yes.
And what's that like?
Familiar territory in some way. I mean, I feel really lucky because I really kind of my role in that is in a way more on the creative side and less technical. But, you know, it also I'm coming to that role with, you know, a lot of experience being in the world of menswear as well as women's. And so there is something really instinctual and references that I think a lot of people probably don't have that are involved in the store that could be doing that. And so I feel certainly qualified to a certain degree, even though I don't know what I'm doing every time. I'm sort of learning, but I think I'm also learning that every time, every season is different from the next, and you're going to constantly be thinking, I could have done better.
Yes. Well, and also I start every market. Mm-hmm. That night before, I panic and think, oh my God, what if I don't have taste? What if I don't know what I'm doing?
You know? I know.
And then I really do. I mean, I've done it for 21 years. And then you get to that first appointment and you know all of the things. Like, you know exactly how you feel about
it. Exactly. I mean, it's kind of immediate reaction. I mean, sometimes it's really easy to get swept up in sort of these people's moments that really isn't yours. Especially in the beginning, you're just a little bit too giddy about it all. But, you know, you settle into it. And my first appointment in Paris always is Dries, which is, you know.
So overwhelming.
So overwhelming, but also so much fun. And it's a real test to your editing process. And, and I come out of that appointment and I feel like, okay, I'm ready for whatever hits me.
Yeah.
You know, I can handle that. I can handle anything.
Which, by the way, I think being a stylist really is being an editor.
Completely. I mean.
And being a buyer is 100% being an editor.
You know, and you know, it's just funny how so many of the different things that I have done over these years all sort of play into each other. And, you know, the work that I did at Barney's dressing mannequins was a testing ground for becoming a stylist. And the shopping for the jobs I did for a stylist is the editing process of buying for, you know, I mean, it all is all kind of connected. And so I say I'm not qualified, but, or don't know what I'm doing, but you know, I'm just doing it through a different venue in some way. So it is all connected.
Scott.
Yes, dear.
We ask people what they wore to prom.
Oh gosh. Well, I've got pictures. I actually do. It's hard to believe. I had two of them. 11th and 12th grade.
Look at you.
I guess
everybody. How many people in your junior, class, senior, by the way?
44.
44 people in your class.
Yeah.
So it was you were juniors were invited. I mean,
exactly.
They had to because it would have been
otherwise
there
would be 10 people there. Yeah. So
That's hilarious.
The first year it was 1977. So of course I wore baby
light blue
tux.
Obviously.
You know,
ruffles.
Matched my yeah, of course, the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, dark blue bow tie, velvet bow tie.
Oh really?
All that stuff.
Velvet bow tie. I don't know that I remember that.
Yeah.
What color shoes does one wear with that?
I think there's shiny black ones that just come with it.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
And then I wore.
And did you go to Jackson to get that?
Like, I did. I went to the mall. In fact, I can't remember what the name of that shop was, but it was at Jackson Mall or Metro Center or something. And
okay.
It was a tuxedo shop.
Right.
You know. And then the next year I went for a pale gray with yellow, with like butter yellow. So it was a gray tuxedo with a yellow shirt and.
Did these match your dates dresses? Like, was this a...
Yes.
Okay, always?
Yes. And,
I mean, this is something you talk about beforehand.
I guess so, because my first date, Perry Ann...
She was like, I really want you to wear
like
blue.
She wore this little like white kind of peasanty thing.
Cool.
With these beautiful little pale blue and pink embroidered flowers on this thing that fell over the top. It was really pretty.
Oh, how pretty.
And then Bonnie, who was like Farrah... wore this sort of yellow spaghetti strap slinky.
I love that.
Sexy dress. And so that was there was that yellow. So I guess we obviously did talk.
That's really cool.
So it was funny. Don't have photographs of that though.
You don't.
I've got a Polaroid of myself in the blue tux.
I've seen it
somewhere, which is kind of crazy. I look like a vampire. Anyway,
do you think blue tuxes will come back?
Didn't Gucci do that?
Yeah, maybe he did.
I mean,
yeah,
I hope that they don't, because I really, it was a moment that we don't need to really go back to.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. It was great.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.